Welcome back to this week's special edition of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to us either at Rational Radio, 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas, or at cindysheehansoapbox.com. I'm in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts this week. We are protesting the wars. We're protesting Obama's continuance of George Bush's policy. And while we've been here this past week, Senator Ted Kennedy passed away. So I'd like to send us special condolences out to his family and to the people of Massachusetts and really to the people of this country. He was a senator since 1962. He was involved in many important pieces of civil rights legislation, education legislation. He was a peace candidate starting in Vietnam. And he said, and he told me personally in a meeting that we had back in September of 2005, that voting against the invasion of Iraq was the proudest vote of his career. So we really want to dedicate our work for peace to Senator Ted Kennedy. Unfortunately, it seems like many members of the anti-war movement have gone on a vacation from protests now that we have a Democratic president. And it just makes me wonder if the past 8 years we've had an anti-Bush movement and not an anti-war movement. Well, we just need to get off of our couches, get back out into the streets. We have a democratically controlled government, and if there is a time for change, it's now. But they're not going to change unless we force them to change, and that's why we're here on Martha's Vineyard. Today, we'll be speaking to my guest, Ellen Brown, from her home in California. She's an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. Stay tuned. After this break, we'll be right back with my guest, Ellen Brown.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Ellen Brown developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In her book, Web of Debt, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we, the people, can get that power back. I'm all about getting power back. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Cindy. It's great to be talking to you.
Well, thank you. I've read your work that you do around economic issues, and it's very intriguing to me. And I just read your latest article about how the reason why China's economy is so strong lately. But before we talk about that, I want to talk about your book, Web of Debt. And I haven't had a chance to read your book yet. I have it, but in the description of it, it says that creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. I'd like you to explain that statement to my listeners, and you can take as long as you want to explain, because I know these are very important issues.
Well, most people think that money is created by the government, and of course the government does create coins, and that's where we get this idea, because the coins are clearly created by the government, and they're issued debt-free. And then there's paper Federal Reserve notes, which say that they're covered by the full faith and credit of the United States. So we assume those are issued by the government, but they aren't. They're issued by the Federal Reserve, a private banking corporation. I mean, it's privately owned by many banks, set up in 1913 as our private central bank. And between those two, they still only issue 3% of the money supply. So 97% of the money supply is created by banks themselves when they issue loans.
Tell us how that works, and how does that? I'm really interested in how does that profit the private banks, and how does it harm the investor, the depositor, the person who takes out loans.
The banks, for one thing, of course, get the interest, and so they're making interest on typically over 30 years, you pay more in interest than you pay in principal. So they're making a healthy sum in interest, but based on the fractional reserve system, the standard system is 10% reserve. $10 of deposits will get you $100 in loans. So it's not like they're just making 6% or whatever on one loan, because they can leverage their money into 10 times that in loans. So they're really making 50% or so on their loans. I mean, they're making a very good interest rate. The downside, the reserve requirement came into existence. It goes back to the 17th century when the goldsmiths discovered that people would only come for their gold 10% of the time on average. The goldsmiths were entrusted with people's gold. They didn't want to carry it around. It was dangerous and heavy. So the goldsmiths gave them these little receipts called banknotes, and they soon discovered that they could issue 10 times as many banknotes as they had gold. Other people would want to borrow gold, but they didn't want the actual gold either. They wanted the paper because it was more convenient. So the bankers, the goldsmiths-turned-bankers, discovered that they could issue up to 10 times as many notes as they had gold. So that's why it's actually banker-issued money, but the bankers could always say, well, no, these are just little receipts for gold. You can bring your receipt in at any time, and we'll give you the gold. So we haven't created anything. You can get your gold. The fraud was that many more receipts were created than gold, and so periodically people would figure that out. And they would all come for their gold at the same time, and that was a bank run where the bank didn't have it, and they'd have to close their doors. But that was attributed to just bad banking practices of each individual bank. I mean, nobody looked at the whole system and said, "Wait, this whole system is fraudulent." So that system was perpetuated, and rather than calling off the whole deal because it was based on a fraud, more and more things have been put in place to keep the system going. The Federal Reserve was set up to backstop banks after a particularly bad bank run in 1907, or a bank panic that was actually instigated, it seems. There is evidence that it was instigated by J.P. Morgan himself, and it was he who set up was in charge of this group that set up the Federal Reserve system. So the idea was to get the power to issue money in private hands. In fact, there's this famous quote that may be apocryphal, but it really is what they were doing. It goes back to Nathan Rothschild, Amschel Rothschild, I guess, the patriarch of the Rothschild family, who said, "Allow me to issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who creates its laws." In other words, their plan was to control everything privately by controlling the creation and the lending of money. And they have not.
What about Ford?
Henry Ford's quote that if the people really understood the banking system, they would like revolt by morning.
Yeah. No, he was being cynical because he said, as well they don't understand, because if they did, we'd have a revolution.
As well they don't understand.
But it's time that we understood. And there is a much more logical way we could set the system up where it would actually be mathematically sound. In fact...
Well, I do want to talk about that, and I've been impressed with your work about, if I'm not mistaken, that you were talking about our own state. I live in California. You live in California. Mm-hmm. Setting up its own bank to help our economic crisis we're having in California.
Well, the original.
Well, maybe we could tie that in with how nationalizing the banks, like they do in China, with the brilliant article you just wrote. How doing that nationally, or having a Bank of California, explain to my listeners how that would help the monetary system and our economy.
The original American system was publicly issued money. Well, right now there's only one state that owns its own bank, only one publicly owned bank. That is the Bank of North Dakota. 38 out of 50 states are currently unable to meet their budgets. They're essentially bankrupt or insolvent, either this year or next year. One of the two that isn't is North Dakota, and there's no way to explain this. I mean, there's nothing up there. They're farmers in adverse weather conditions, but they set up their own publicly owned bank in 1919. The farmers got together because they were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers, very similar situation to what we have now. So they got together, passed legislation that all the state's revenues would go in their own bank, the Bank of North Dakota. And then the bank is able to do what any bank does, which is leverage their deposits into many times that sum in loans. So they have their own credit mechanism. They're not dependent on Wall Street. They're not dependent on... they're not hooked into this whole derivatives mess that everybody else is going under from. So they have plenty of money for student loans. They give low-interest loans to farmers. They partner with the other banks so that the other banks don't feel threatened, but are actually, like the Bank of North Dakota, it's like their own. They have their own central bank in the state. They're self-insured and not FDIC-insured. You know, the FDIC is now bankrupt, but that's not a problem for them because the state insures the whole system. So it's working out really well for them. And that is the same model that Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania followed, where they had their own bank, which then would lend money to farmers at a much better rate than they could get from the British bankers, who were hardly there anyway. So in this way, they got a credit system going in Pennsylvania. Before that, nobody wanted to come to Pennsylvania. And then all of a sudden, because there was some money there, because you had the medium of exchange, then people were flooding in to get business going because it was possible to conduct business. All we're missing in California is the credit. We were used to be doing quite well until this credit freeze, and that's when everything fell off.
Well, it's interesting to me that our state has asked for a bailout, and I believe it's somewhere around $24 billion. You know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. And we were told no, that if they bail California out, they would have to bail all of the states out. Well, to me, if you pump money into a state economy to keep jobs and to keep social service programs going, it's more of an effective stimulus plan than giving money to AIG. Why, if AIG or Goldman Sachs needs money, there's always money, and they don't say, well, if we bail you out, we'll have to bail out Wells Fargo or something. It's just really amazing to me that it seems like the stimulus that was first brought about by Bush and continued by Obama seems to be only wanting to stimulate the banksters and Wall Street's economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's $26 billion, and if you gave that to all the states, 50 states, that would be like $1.2 trillion. Well, we've already given more money than that to the banks, and it's not working. It's not getting the credit flowing again. So you're right. They should be giving it directly to the states. And how is it that these 9 lucky banks that got the TARP money are too big to fail, but California, the eighth largest economy in the world, is not too big to fail. In fact, they wouldn't. Timothy Geithner wouldn't even guarantee a $5 billion line of credit, which the governor asked for. So, I mean, that's just a guarantee. It's not even giving us money, whereas the banks, actually, we actually handed them
right.
$15 to $25 billion each, which is what California needs.
And trillions of dollars of money at this point. I don't want you to speculate about motives or whatever, but why do you think it is? Why do you think that the banks get all the money they need, but when the states ask for money, they say that there's no money available?
The banks originally got it. What started this whole bailout thing was when Lehman Brothers collapsed on September 15th, and there was a $550 billion run on the money markets. Like half a trillion dollars was pulled out of the money markets all at once on the next trading day. So Henry Paulson went to Congress and said that we were going to have an entire collapse of our whole banking system if Congress didn't step in and bail out all these banks. And they believed that. But that's the thing. Everybody thinks that if we don't prop up these banks, we won't have a credit system. But that's not true. We can set up. It seems to me that they're in control of Congress, and it's probably not possible to persuade Congress to change the system. But we could set up our own systems in the states, set up our own publicly owned banks, and get credit flowing in a way that the private banks haven't been able to do and that Wall Street hasn't been able to do. So we don't have to try to oppose them, and we don't have to hand them money to bail them out. We can just set up a better mousetrap, and when everybody sees that it works better, they'll just automatically, naturally move over into the better system.
Well, you know, you said that the banks are in control, or the bankers are in control of Congress, and in your latest article, you do put a quote from U.S. Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, and he says, the banks, hard to believe in a time when we are facing a banking crisis, that many of the banks create, a crisis that many of the banks created, are still the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill. They frankly own the place. So, you know, a very powerful, long-serving senator says that the banks own the place. Like you said, there's not going to be any meaningful legislation regulating the banks or overturning the Federal Reserve System or even auditing the Federal Reserve System. So that's not going to happen in the federal level. Do we still have that kind of control by the banking system on our state-level politics?
Well, certainly the banks are powerful, and it might be a difficult case to make in California because of our governor, but there are other states that are more, like Washington State is a possibility. They've expressed, or, you know, people have expressed an interest, and I guess the governor is very progressive. It could certainly be done, it seems to me. And in California, we have the power of the initiative. So if people understood the issues, that's the first hurdle. I can just see trying to get people to sign an initiative in the grocery store, and you say, would you like to sign this initiative for a state bank, they won't know what you're talking about or why that's a good thing. So that's why I keep writing and writing. But assuming people understood the issues, we the people could cause this to happen just with an initiative.
Well, we'll continue that line of thought and discussion when we come back. We have to take a quick break right now. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. and Rational Radio, 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas. We'll be right back to continue our conversation with Ellen Brown after this break.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehansSoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas. My guest today is Ellen Brown. Ellen, you've talked about, because we do have the state initiative in California, we've had some really good propositions pass, we've had some really bad propositions pass, but is there any kind of movement that you're aware of to have a proposition that would create a state bank?
Well, it's only... I'm working with people myself, and Marcy Winograd's working on. Several of us are petitioning legislators and so forth. But it does seem that the first attempt should be to actually get the legislature to do it, because obviously it would be more direct. But if that fails, we could do an initiative. But what I see as the problem is just understanding the issues. But there is, I think you can now do an initiative on the internet. Is that correct? Can you sign? So you could arguably make your whole case on the internet and then have people sign a petition.
You can have people sign petitions on the internet now? I had no idea.
I think I heard that.
I don't know. I just ran for Congress, and we were out pounding the streets for months to people to sign my petition to get me on the ballot. Marcy Winograd is a friend of mine from Los Angeles, too, who's very active in politics and very active in progressive politics. How have you been received up in Sacramento about this?
Well, we haven't gone to Sacramento, but we've spoken to some legislators down here, and we had a conference call with some people from the Treasurer's office, and the Controller's office. And here, last week, we talked to Carol Liu, who's a senator here in Glendale, and she was very interested. So,
well, it seems like you could get some conservatives on board with this, because I think a former presidential candidate and congressman from Texas, Ron Paul, has been very big on these kind of issues. Do you have people who tend to be more politically conservative working with you?
Well, we were supposed to talk to George Renner yesterday, who's a Republican, and he's vice chair of the Finance Committee, but I guess they were all called up to Sacramento, so...
Uh-huh.
So that got put off. In my own experience, you know, a lot of people write to me, and both sides are interested in monetary reform, and they're both interested in this approach. It is interesting that it doesn't seem to be a political approach. Well, it was like in North Dakota. They called it the Nonpartisan League, and really what
mm-hmm.
it was just a bunch of farmers who
mm-hmm.
wanted to get a banking system back.
Okay, well, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's go back to the Federal Reserve. Here on Martha's Vineyard, where I'm protesting Obama's war policies. He did have Ben Bernanke over to reappoint him as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And I think some people, you know, when you were saying that it's not a federal agency, it's a private agency, I think some people get confused because the president does appoint the chairman, and if I'm not mistaken, he also appoints the presidents of each of the Federal Reserve districts in this country. And do you think that that's a confusion? That gives people confusion. Is it really totally private, or is it quasi-private?
No, it's a mixture, but it's definitely their whole mandate is to preserve the banking system. So they work for the banks, and that's the way the whole Federal Reserve Act is set up. So, for instance, when they were, the question was whether they could give California money, and I think Tim, well, of course, that's the Treasury, but anyway, you would have to change the legislation because the Federal Reserve Act only allows the Federal Reserve to give money to the banks. That's the way it's set up. It doesn't say that the Federal Reserve can make loans to states. They're doing it anyway. You know, they're making loans to consumers. They're making loans places they've never made before under this one little paragraph that says that in an emergency, in exigent circumstances, the Federal Reserve can do unusual things. You know, it's one of those blanket clauses that gives them mm-hmm. extra powers. And under that, they've now, well, they're up to something like $25 trillion in commitments, potential commitments. I mean, the potential that we're on the hook is now like $25 trillion, which obviously we couldn't possibly afford.
Yeah. And so what do you think about the bipartisan bill in Congress to audit the Federal Reserve?
I think it's an excellent idea. But like you, I have my doubts whether it's actually going to happen because the argument is that if it's like making sausage, if everybody knew what it looked like, nobody would buy into it, and they think that this would be the destruction of the system to let everybody see what was really going on. That, in other words, that the mystery, or they would call it confidence in the system is what makes it work, because it's only
backed
by faith, the full faith and credit of the United States. But that's not true. You could have a totally transparent system that still worked. It's the private system that won't work unless there's some chicanery involved, some deception.
Well, H.R. 1207 has 282 co-sponsors, and they come from the far left and the far right. And it seems to me that is a mandate to bring it up for a vote. Of course, the president would veto it probably, even if it passed the Senate, which it probably wouldn't pass the Senate. But, you know, that would be another way, I think, to call attention to the fact that the Federal Reserve is a secretive organization that's working against the American people, against the American economy, really, for the bankers' economy.
Right.
Well, you wrote a really great article that I read probably like a year ago, and it was called "It's the Derivatives, Stupid." And derivatives is a really difficult thing for most people to understand, but you explained it in a pretty clear, almost, you know,
understandable
way. Can you tell my listeners, explain to my listeners about derivatives, what they are, and why they are being so harmful to our economy?
Mm-hmm. Well, the point of that article was everyone thought that it was the subprime lenders that had brought the system down, or it was all about that. But the subprime borrowers. But it's actually all about the derivatives, and the reason they had to do this whole bailout and bail out AIG, who is, you know, clearly a crook here, is because they're hooked into this whole multi-trillion-dollar derivative scheme. American credit default swaps of U.S. banks total something like $60 trillion. Total derivatives on the books of U.S. banks is around $180 trillion. Total derivative trades worldwide are over $250 billion, according to the Bank for International Settlements. It's an absolutely huge market. But what it is just bets, basically bets. So you have counterparties. So one party, for instance, a credit default swap, you have one party that sells premiums against defaults, and the other party buys the premiums. So they call it insurance. So you're buying insurance against default. But really, you're just the party that's supposed to pay the insurance. There's no insurance commissioner that checks to make sure that party has the money. They're just gambling that they're not going to have to pay up. They're literally gambling because they wouldn't have the money to pay up if there were a widespread default. But it used to be thought that housing never goes down, and so it was like a sure bet to be selling these credit default swaps. That's what AIG, I read an article, and that's what they actually, how they sold this whole plan was, don't worry, housing never goes down. What's the risk? So, of course, it did at some point. Inevitably, it turned around, and it wasn't just like ordinary insurance where you have one fire here and one fire there, and then the other houses pay for it. The whole town burned down at once because there was a whole collapse at once. So the counterparties, instead of paying up, these were like hedge funds, they would just go bankrupt and drop out of the game. And say, well, we made plenty of money over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, we'll just take our winnings and leave. We use the corporate veil, the corporate shield to escape personal liability. So they would just drop out of the game. Well, so that was the problem. It's this whole network of bets against each other. So if you let one big counterparty fail, like AIG, then all the bets on the other side are going to fail too, because it's the habit of all these players to bet both ways. So they will bet for something, and again, you can bet on anything, like the price of tea in China. So you might bet that the tea will go up, and then you'd bet that tea would go down. And then you're gambling on the spread. You're going to make money on the difference between the two. But if the bet that you won doesn't pay up, you're not going to be able to pay up the bet that you lost. And so all the whole edifice could collapse at once. So you can just imagine if we had like $250 billion worth of bets that all collapse at once. Everybody's afraid because it's like a neutron bomb. Nobody knows what would happen. First of all, a lot of things like pension funds can only buy AAA-rated investments.
Right.
So they get their AAA rating because they're protected against default with these credit default swaps. Well, if you take away the credit default swaps, suddenly these aren't AAA investments. So the pension funds would instantly, automatically just sell all that stuff. So it would all flood into the market at once. That's what happened on September 15th when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and all the money market funds flooded out at once. It's like program trading. It just triggered their computers and it all came out at once. So that's what everybody's afraid of, that you'll have all these AAA investments that suddenly aren't AAA. So there'll be this sudden flood of sales, and then that would bring down the whole stock market and you would have something like 1929.
Well, I've heard many economists on, you know, all ends of the political spectrum and in between say that we've had the dot-com bubble, we had the real estate bubble, and a lot of people claim that the Federal Reserve creates these bubbles. And it seems to me, especially if I'm looking at the housing bubble, is that these people were making money when the bubble was inflating. And by people, I mean, you know, people that are insuring the credit default swaps or the mortgage-backed securities, and the people who are making the loans. And so they're making money when the bubble's inflating, but when the bubble breaks, it's the people on the ground who got mortgages that suffer and lose their homes, but the people like AIG are being bailed out by the government, and it's probably not dollar for dollar, but it seems like they have no risk, that there's like no risk for who I call the banksters, and we're the ones that absorb all the risk and all of the harm in, you know, mortgage owners or small businesses or whatever. We're the ones that absorb that, where the banksters are practically risk-free. Their lives are almost monetarily risk-free.
Mm-hmm. Well, Goldman Sachs got something like, was either $12 billion or $13 billion out of AIG.
But right.
As a counterparty, they got paid off on some of these derivatives bets when AIG got their bailout money. And they're like a party to all these transactions. So it's all totally corrupt and crooked when you see into it. But then the question is, how do we stop them? I mean, they have total control. And they make the case that they have to bail out all these, even though everybody knows they're crooks, they have to bail them all out or else we won't have a credit system. So that's why I think we have to just abandon that whole system. And we can create our own, then we don't need their system.
Right. Many small business owners that I know are having trouble getting credit. And I talk to mortgage brokers, you know, on the ground floor level, trying to just get people into homes now, and they say that credit is really hard to obtain right now. And, you know, when they say we have to bail out these big banks so they can get credit flowing, to me that just seems like a circular trap that, okay, give them my tax money, bail them out, and then they can loan me money at interest.
Right.
My own money? They can
totally
loan me my own money back at interest?
Yeah. Well, the reason they can't lend right now, the reason they were doing all this enormous lending, which is what drove the stock, the housing prices up, was that they're allowed to, what really limits lending is the capital requirement, and it's imposed from abroad by the Bank for International Settlements. So it's very complicated, but roughly it's like $8 of capital will get you $100 in loans. So before, they would have their $8 in capital, which is real money. It's like the money they get from their stockholders. It's not deposits of somebody else. It's their own money. So before, they would have $8 of capital, and then they could make $100 in loans. And then they would bundle up all those loans, turn them into securities, chop them up, and sell them off to investors. And then they could make another $100 in loans with that same $8 in capital. So they were just churning all this money, leveraging it, selling it off to investors. But the investors, called the shadow lenders, after the summer of 2007, when those two Bear Stearns hedge funds went bankrupt, they realized that they were being sold lemons, and they quit buying. So the shadow lenders have gone away. So the banks will say, well, we're fully loaned up. We've made all the loans we're allowed to make under the rules. You know, we've got our $8 of capital and our $100 in loans. But that was the problem, that there's nobody taking these loans off their books. So they really are stalled.
Uh-huh.
And now the FDIC is going to do another assessment against the banks because they don't have the money to even pay the depositors. So that means the good banks, the ones that were behaving rationally and prudently, are going to have to cough up money out of their capital base to pay the bad banks. So that's going to put them more in jeopardy, so they're going to be able to make even fewer loans and are going to be even closer to bankruptcy themselves. So it's just totally, they've messed up their books totally. I mean, you could blame it on the Bank for International Settlements, and in fact, I'm going to make that case on 9/11.
Oh. Well, we have probably time for one more question. And my question would be, Ellen, I can't believe that our time is already almost up, because this is just such a, you know, complicated subject and something that hopefully we'll be able to have you back on to go more in depth in. But, you know, every day I watch the mainstream media news like MSNBC or CNN or whatever, and they say that the economy is recovering because Wall Street had a good day today. You know, do you see any optimism in a recovery soon, or do you think that so I have two questions. Do you have optimism in a recovery? My second question is, do you think Wall Street's ups and downs, highs and lows, are a good indicator of economic recovery?
No, I think that they're totally, that we've got two different economies going here, and their economy is doing well because we've propped it up. But it's at the expense of our own economy, that, you know, Main Street and Wall Street. Main Street is suffering. And certainly, just looking around you, I know many people who can't get a job. They're really very worried because they've got mortgages and they don't know how they're going to pay them. Things are going down, down, down for ordinary people. Now, in Wall Street or in the stock market, I think, for instance, China probably will do well if they, as long as they don't create their own bubbles. And, you know, Japan went over the edge, created a bubble, and got in trouble. But if China continues to feed internal development, which is what we should be doing, China owns their own banks. They have publicly owned banks, which can create credit on their books, and they're using that credit to build stuff and put people to work, which is getting their economy booming again. We could do that, and we should do that. The problem is we don't have the banking system to do it. But if we set up a banking system like that, for instance, nationalize the Federal Reserve, that could solve the problem. But it is at the federal level, so it's going to be difficult to do.
Well, my show is an internet show, and it's heard in Dallas, Texas. So people from all the states listen to my show. So hopefully we can get something going. And if we can't nationalize, you know, the central bank of the United States, then maybe we can start working on movements to nationalize our state banks. Make state banks.
State-owned bank. You can
sweep all the other banks like
private.
They do.
Yeah.
Which state did you say has state-owned bank?
One has it, North Dakota. So
North Dakota has their state-owned bank. Maybe based on that model, so we can actually have an economy that works for us. Ellen, tell my listeners where they can read your articles and check out your book, Web of Debt.
Okay, my website is webofdebt.com, and all my articles are linked at the top, and then they're posted various places like Huffington Post and Op-Ed News and Global Research.
Well, good job, Ellen. Keep on educating people about this problem. You do a really good job, and you make things understandable, you know, to an average person that doesn't have an economics degree, because these are very complicated issues. Well, thanks for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today, Ellen.
Oh, thank you, and I love your enthusiasm. I love the work you do. You just keep forging ahead.
Well, thank you. Say hi to Marcy and all my LA friends for me.
Okay.
Hope we can talk to you soon.
Okay, likewise.
Thank you. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox at cindysheehansoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 AM. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. That was our guest, Ellen Brown. We'll be right back with some interviews that we did here on Martha's Vineyard. Stay tuned.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi. Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Sheehan, anti-war leader and host of Cindy Sheehan Soapbox at cindysheehansoapbox.com. We're here at Martha's Vineyard to protest the policies of the Obama administration, particularly when they concern Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. We are gathered on his vacation, and this is his $50,000 a week vacation home right across the pond from where I'm going to be staying tonight. Our message to Obama, our message to the world, our message to the United States is we protested the policies when George Bush was president, and we protest these same policies when Obama is president, because it's not about the president, it's about the system. Now, I want to bring on as my first guest, Missy Beatty. And Missy Beatty is going to tell us her philosophy of war crimes. Missy? Welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Missy Beatty is a Gold Star aunt. Her nephew, Chase Comley, was killed in Iraq on August 6, 2005. Missy, tell us about what you think of Obama and his continuation of the Bush policies.
I think that Obama is just another Bush. Obama is
a
war criminal.
I'm not prompting, I guess.
Bush was a war criminal. Bush is a war criminal. Bush should be arrested. Obama is now a war criminal. With his first drone attack in the Swat Valley of Pakistan, he became a war criminal. With the continued presence of troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq, he's a war criminal.
What do you tell people, Missy, and I know you get a lot of feedback on your rhetoric, which I agree with 100%. But what do you tell people when people say, these are not Obama's wars, he didn't start them?
Obama expressed prior to the election that he was, Afghanistan is the right war. But as soon as he took the oath of office, he continued the war in Iraq. He continued the droning of Pakistan. So he's a war criminal.
And I think, too, is that if we call George Bush a war criminal, which, like you said, we did, and he is, and if Obama's doing the same thing, then, you know, ipso facto, that makes Obama a war criminal.
Definitely.
And if people on the so-called left want to reject that, then they can't call Bush a war criminal if they don't extend that same label to Obama.
Right. So, and Obama, I know so many people have such hope for him. And I think that he's going to turn off an entire generation of youth who signed up to vote just because they expected change, and they're not getting it. They're just getting the same old Bush policies.
Well, tell us, Missy, why you came to Martha's Vineyard. What do you think about the president taking a $50,000 a week vacation when how many of our soldiers have died? I think 7 so far since I've been. 4, 5 in Afghanistan, 2 in Iraq, have died since I've been on the Vineyard.
Right, and there's no vacation from war, from death. And I think that it's important that we talk about not just our own troop deaths and the devastation of troop families, but what we're doing to the people whose countries we invade and occupy.
And that's an excellent point. That's who we work for. You know, many people have said, Cindy, you should go away. Obama's president now. What you're doing is wrong. It was okay for you to protest when Bush was president. It's not okay for you to protest when Obama's president. What I say to those people, who's going to speak for the children? If everybody in America, the right aren't going to speak for the children that we're bombing because they've supported it all along. The right, the left aren't speaking out now because they have their president in office. So some of us, and there is a core group of us here who are speaking for the children of the world, not just American children, but certainly children of Gaza, children of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq. And you know what? We're here even to bring a more peaceful world to Malia and Sasha Obama.
Yes.
So we're equal opportunity protesters, but we want to build an equal opportunity world where all children can live in peace. Right?
Right.
Right. Thank you for tuning in to this YouTube edition of Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
My next guest today is Iraq war resister Mathis Chereau. Mathis, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having me on, Cindy.
Oh, no problem. Mathis is joining us on Martha's Vineyard to protest the wars of occupation that Obama is continuing. Mathis was a war resister for the Iraq war, and I want Mathis to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about why you came to the vineyard. So tell us about your process of coming to the decision that you weren't going to be deployed to Iraq, and then what happened.
Sure, Cindy. Well, I was an Army journalist for 5 years. I was actually discharged from active duty. I moved to Brooklyn, New York, where about 7 months later I received call-up orders to deploy to Iraq. Initially, I was planning to go because I thought it was my job as a soldier to follow orders, even if I had been against these wars since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching you in Camp Casey way back when I was in uniform and praying that was going to be it.
Yeah.
But I got out, and initially I was going to go. Because
was this on the stop loss, or was it the individual ready reserve sort of?
I was in the individual ready reserve. It was forced reactivation.
Okay.
What ended up happening is I actually called the military, and I said, well, I'm going to come, but I'm in school right now. Can you postpone it till summer? They said, sure. Fortunately, between that time and summer, I was exposed to the winter soldier testimonies in Washington, D.C. And exactly. And suddenly it dawned on me that this war is going to continue until we, the soldiers, demand that it stop. And furthermore, that if I do hold the belief that these are illegal wars of aggression and occupation, that not only is it my right to say no, it's my responsibility.
Right, exactly.
So I stood up actually in Congress after Winter Soldier on the Hill. 9 of our members testified, and I stood up and I said, my name is Sergeant Chereau, and I'm not going to Iraq, and I'm not going to Canada, and I'm not going into hiding. If the Army has a problem with me, they can come find me in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So I spent about a month and a half in Congress, actually, speaking to members of the Democratic Party, because I still had a lot of faith that they wanted to do the right thing.
And mm-hmm.
Actually, 13 of them signed a letter of support for me, including John Conyers, Jr. The Army still decided to charge me with misconduct anyway. They tried to send me a discharge through the mail, and I said, absolutely not, I demand a hearing. And so I demanded a hearing, and I went and I sat before a board of officers, made my arguments, was surprised not to be persecuted, and actually given a discharge under honorable conditions.
Wow.
So we are hoping and praying that this becomes a precedent for other war resisters who, like me, understand it to be their responsibility, not just their right to resist.
Well, good for you, Mathis. My son was against the war. He was against George Bush, but he went because he felt it was his duty. And he was only on post 5 hours before he was killed. And, you know, I would rather have him in prison or in Canada than to be dead for these lies, for this deception. And you are a member of Iraq Vets Against the War.
That's correct, ma'am.
And you're on the board, the National
Board of Directors.
And I want to say that Iraq Vets Against the War is one of the only large anti-war groups that have endorsed our actions here on Martha's Vineyard. And Mathis, tell us why you came to Martha's Vineyard.
Well, I've been dreaming of protesting with you, Cindy, like I said, since I was in the military. when I heard you were going to be up here and taking this message directly to Obama, I knew it was time to move. The anti-war movement for the last few months has been very hesitant to directly take on Obama and what are now his policies of immoral and illegal occupation. So this is one of the first demonstrations that I've seen take this message directly to Obama and put him in the hot seat. Mm-hmm. This is where we need to be as a movement. This is where we need to be as IVAW. So I was very honored to be able to come up and offer our endorsement and to stand with you here in Martha's Vineyard, because Obama is not a peace president. He is not going to end the war unless we force him.
Well, I think it's going to be really hard for us to get a peace president. Obama is president because Obama is not a peace president. But I want to give you an opportunity. I support the work of IVAW 100%, and they are having a fundraising drive right now. Mathis, I want to give you the opportunity to tell my viewers and my listeners about your fundraising drive. And I would urge anybody who can to send whatever you can to IVAW.
Well, what IVAW is doing right now is we're working on building an army of sustainers. We're trying to sign up people who are willing to give small amounts each month, $10, $15 over a longer period of time. We're trying to build our organizing in a sustainable manner, and part of that is not waiting for large injections of cash, but building a base that's willing to sustain and not just give us money, but literally buy into the mission of IVAW and support us. So we are trying to sign up people online. We're sending around these little cards. $10, $15 a month over 1 year does far more for our organizing abilities than single checks for very large amounts, which we do appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Right, and what's your website?
Our website is ivaw.org. There are links to donate on the site. And you can sign up to be a sustainer through there. Again, we're encouraging people, rather than giving us large sums of money in chunks, to break that up over a longer period of time so we can organize in a sustainable economic way.
And we've had anti-war groups made up of mostly military veterans for peace, Vietnam Vets Against the War, who are still working. They've been working, you know, now for decades, and the veteran's voice is a very important voice that needs to be heard. So I encourage the viewers and listeners to go and donate whatever you can. And that, like Mathis said, if we get a bunch of people donating a small amount, then there's not so much burden on a single person or the large donors that we all know in the movement. We're losing them because of the economy. So Mathis, thank you so much for coming to Martha's Vineyard to stand here with me. Thank you, IVAW, for supporting this action. And it was great to meet you and have you on the soapbox.
You too, Cindy.
Thanks a lot.
That's Cindy Sheehan's soapbox today. Again, I'd like to thank you as always for listening. And I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, and my guest, Ellen Brown. So stay tuned next week. I'm sure we'll have a great show.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know. The air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone.
Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.